How are we doing now? Yep. I've discovered my easiest way of finding out whether this is on is to stand underneath this speaker over here, maybe. If I can get it, if I can pull off the Jimi Hendrix thing, I know that the feedback indicates that I'm on. So, okay. Since we took our break and have a little bit of an opportunity to either put some more caffeine into us or remove some from us, depending on how you used your break. It gives a chance for me, in a little bit less pressured way, to take a look at this issue of financial costs. So just to keep us on schedule and on track, we're gonna cover some issues around costs and means of paying, and then I'm going to stop and bring us back out to a planning perspective. Okay? So, now, here's the good news. It took me a little bit of research, but I get excited about this kind of stuff. We actually have fresh data. There are a number of quite valid sources, reliable and valid sources that have been proven over time to provide us regularly updated information, even about down to our local geographic areas, metro areas, zip codes, so not quite to the zip code level, but metro areas at least, about the costs of long-term care. So the good news is you guys happen to come at this meeting when I'm not having to throw out to you, you know, asterisk-laden 2004, 2005 statistics here, okay? This stuff is data that was from March the 17th of 2014. You like that one? All right, so this is fresh data, and it's actually from one of the more reliable sources for this. I'll give credit where credit is due. This is Genworth. Is a long-term care insurance, is an insurance provider, long-term care, annuities, life insurance, that was once a part of General Electric Finance. So for whatever it's worth, this is Genworth's data. It's consistent with other data that was recently acquired from both public sources and private sources. So I'm going to use these numbers and feel pretty good about them. Okay, so some of you are in the thick of this. So you can tell me what is let's see how we break this down, home care. What do you believe would be the, if you wanted 5 days a week of care for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. You can take care of the weekends, but you want somebody there to come into the home as a home health aide to care for an older adult for 5 days a week, okay? How much would that cost you per year?
$41,000.
Actually, I think Ann gets close enough on a game show, I think, that we would give you. In fact, I can't remember the one that's on National Public Radio right about this time, but you know they always have to say, close enough, good enough. You get, because the prizes are so lousy, it doesn't really matter. Sure, we'll give it to you anyway. And the short answer is about $43,000 a year. $43,000. Now, do the math, guys. 24/7 care of that same person. What I just described was 5 days a week for about 8 hours each day. So if you would have to triple that number, right? Am I in about the right ballpark? I have to triple that number if I actually wanted, outside of paying somebody a fixed fee as a live-in person to be there on an informal basis. But if I wanted a professional caregiver at the current prices that are being paid right now, incidentally, on average in Northeast Ohio, right now, people are paying about that's neither here nor there. I'd need obviously an amount of money that was far in excess of what it would cost for me to have that same person in an assisted living facility or a nursing home. You with me? Yeah, more. Sorry, more. I apologize. Yes, so $43,000 per year to get a third of a day, right? We're talking about an extraordinary amount of money to be able to take care of that person on a 24/7 basis if I wanted to keep them at home. All right? We're clear about that. The home health aides, homemakers, those that make up the care that is often provided by an agency coming into the home, are obviously, though, have some degree of flexibility. It's a private arrangement for the most part. Usually, there is a program within the Medicaid publicly paid system called Passport that allows folks to receive, using Medicaid dollars, a limited care plan of home care. But obviously, the advantage is to some degree that you have more flexibility. When do I need this person and for how long a period of time? The agency may have a blocks that they say, we only do it in 2-hour blocks, we only do it in 4-hour blocks, we only do it in 6-hour blocks. You can purchase that. We only do it these particular days or these particular hours. You're going to have to fill in the rest. But there's some flexibility. Now, you'll note that what I'm talking about here is what I'm referring to as formal care. The data that those folks over at Genworth were able to get their hands on is based on people who actually file some kind of public filing that they provided this service and received money for this service. It brings up, and I will not belabor it, but it brings up an important consideration about the degree of black market that there is in home care services in the United States of America. And I got to be straight with you guys, you know, that scriptural approach that we talked about in the beginning, that scripture is God-breathed. It is useful for encouragement. It's useful for exhortation. It is also useful for rebuke. Now, having been now in my 31st year of working in this particular area of life and having lots of private conversations with lots of families who are going to spend eternity with me, I am regularly amazed at the amount of rationalization for paying people under the table and avoiding obligations to the Internal Revenue Service and the Ohio Department of Taxation that people can come up with. Bottom line is, if I hire someone to do a service privately, and I pay them more than $600 in that given year to do so, I am under the legal obligation to submit to them and to the IRS a 1099 that indicated that I did so. If they asked me to pay them in cash, if it was their request, if it's because, you know what, it would cost me too much to do that, and I need the more care than that. Come up with any rationalization you want to. The bottom line is, you know, when Jesus was being pressed with a question about what I owe to God, the first thing he dismissed is, go render to Caesar what Caesar's. Whose face is on that thing? Take care of those obligations to these people and don't be a bad witness about it. So the long and the short of it is that we do have a problem, I believe, based on my limited empirical experience in this, we have a problem within the body of Christ, that we have brothers and sisters who are receiving funds to provide these services who are not planning on disclosing that to the government and paying taxes on it, and we have people who are procuring their services who are perfectly comfortable with that and are being part and parcel to the same situation. That's probably true of folks that clean houses and probably true of people that do contracting work and a whole lot of other things within the body of Christ as well. That's not my problem. This one is. And it's one that I feel very, very strongly that it's very hard in the biblical morality, in the ethics that we are driven toward as followers of Jesus, to say that somehow you can do the right thing in the wrong way. It doesn't work that way. That's not how God looks upon us. And so my encouragement is that if Genworth could somehow get their hands on the black market data, I'd be very interested in seeing how those numbers might change. But these are the official numbers that are being disclosed to folks. And yes, if you wanted to do it on a 24/7 basis, that would be extremely pricey to do. Okay. Community-based respite. How much do you think right now for a year's worth of 5 days a week, 5 days a week, what would it cost for an older adult to go to a day program, let's say, a daycare center, where they could likely receive at least one meal while they were there, be a part of activities, maybe get an assessment, have a nurse regularly there to check to make sure that they're good at some kind of day center. How much do you think 5 days a week that would cost in a year to do that? $15,000 is Ann's proposal? Higher or less? Come on, who's buying? Who's buying right now? $12,000, $30,000. Okay, I love Anne. She's been my friend for a long time now. And I shouldn't say that it bothers me that she keeps being right, you know, that somehow I have a problem with that. But there's some experience here. There's some experience here, clearly, and I want to show honor to it. The numbers from Genworth is $13,520 a year. Now, I want you to stop. $13,520 a year. Now, I just told you how much it costs to get that kind of service at your home to have someone sit and respectfully be in your home environment, which may be for some people a much more dignified, much more comfortable environment, but it is at most in the presence of one other human being or a couple of other human beings as they're passing through. In many cases, it is sitting alongside next to another human being watching television. In some cases, it is sitting in a chair on the opposite end of the apartment or the house while that person is watching your television. So let's be very, very clear that that's a pretty good deal. It's still expensive. But 5 days a week of being able to go to some place where you likely, if it's well run, have other professional human beings peeking in, seeing how mom's doing, seeing how dad's doing, having activities for them to be involved in. Now, any of us that have studied business, right, understand there's these things called economies of scale and economies of scope. Doing something for more people together allows you to gain some efficiencies in this, in certain areas. There's maxes on that. There's diminishing marginal returns for every new person you put in. So get to the wrong daycare, and to be honest with you, it's a mess. It's a zoo. It's chaos. But if it's the right one, for that kind of money, you would get potentially a lot more value than you necessarily would get from the home care environment, and it's at least worth looking at. One has to ask the question, remember when I first described these services to you, these are becoming increasingly common in our community, more so at least. These are becoming more constrained. Community-based solutions are still pretty rare. Still pretty rare. Finding a good daycare in your neighborhood is not necessarily a given thing. And so those kinds of solutions have actually been the least, but as you can see, they're often the most economically efficient to take a look at and to see, can I at least integrate it a little bit? They've been misnomered. There's a misnomer. They've been mislabeled as being respite services. If I come to an elderly spouse and I say, oh, you need some respite. No, I don't. I'm fine. Thank you, young man. I've lived a good bit of my life. I'm tough. Well, do you understand what I did? I characterized it in the wrong context. I put this, you need this because you're weak. You need this because you're not strong enough. You need this because you've fallen apart or because you have caregiver burden. No. How about the fact that you got a life, you got other things you have to do with your time, and it would be really good for your husband to be in the company of some people that knew what they were doing on this and had another set of eyes and ears to be able to be a part of his life. And you know what? He might have some fun. And fun is kind of a good thing. So we've really, to my mind, as a gerontologist, we've totally given a mislabeling of this thing by putting it in the perspective of, oh, we must have those services in order to take give respite and take the burden off of the caregiver. That is true, but it's also just a good way to provide long-term care services in our community, and it's exceedingly rare in some communities. You just can't find it. Assisted living facilities. Okay. In Ohio, we call them residential care facilities. They are licensed facilities. And you'll recall, or if you haven't picked this up yet, broad range of services provided. I mean, literally, the overlap on one end with an independent apartment is stunning at some places. They sometimes refer to them as catered living. It's light assisted living. What is it basically? I'm giving you an apartment, the right to come down to the restaurant if you want to and get a meal, and I'll charge you for that if you want to come down, but I won't bother you if you don't want me to bother you. And I'm going to call it assisted living and get a license for it, okay? But I might have tiers. I'll give you more depending upon what tier you come in at, and my price increases with each tier of care I need to give. And incidentally, let's take a look at the devil in the details of the contract, because one of us has to decide when you're at the next tier. And it generally is the one who's getting paid once you get to that tier, who's getting paid more, is the one that also gets to decide whether you go to that tier. Now, some of these conflicts of interest we've gotten used to in healthcare, right? I mean, you guys go to most, I'm assuming, you receive your healthcare in the United States of America. So you think it's normal that you would go to one person who has a financial incentive to treat you, to give you medications or to do a particular procedure, right? That knee's bugging you. You told by your doc, go see the orthopedist, and he's going to check out your knee. might be a perfectly honorable orthopedist. But you do realize you're about to come and ask the opinion of a person who has a financial interest in fixing your knee, whether you need your knee fixed. There are a handful of really godly, really smart auto mechanics in this town that a lot of us end up frequenting only those people. Why? Because you pop open the hood of my car and I'm in exactly the same situation. If you tell me it's, you know, a cap that needs to be tightened, God bless you, tighten the cap. If you told me it was a total engine rebuild, I'd say the exact same thing. Fix the engine rebuild. I don't know. I had to trust your opinion on what's wrong, and I'm about to pay you for it. In other parts of the world, they consider that crazy. You go to one person that gives you your diagnosis who doesn't have a financial incentive in fixing it, and you're probably going to get a much more fair opinion about whether it actually needs to be done. Here, we think that's normal. Well, same deal here. Assisted living, the key with assisted living is how much assistance. The idea behind it, the positive idea behind it, don't get me wrong, was the idea that there was a place that you could go, unlike a nursing home, there was a place that you can go with negotiated risk and negotiated service. We would only do for you what it appeared you needed to be done, because the goal was that you wanted to retain as many of those functions as possible. The concern being that because of the regulatory environment at a nursing home, I have to do all of that for you. If I take on the liability, if at the nursing home you fall down, I've got an incident report I need to deal with. I need to show that I did some significant things to make sure that that fall down didn't happen. Or you have the right to civilly hold me liable, and the government has the right to be able to penalize me for the care that I provided. At the assisted living, we may choose in the care plan to say, you know what, we're willing to take the chance on the fall. Because we really don't want to give her any more medication to kind of keep her quiet during the night. And she does. She's always been up in the middle of the night. I mean, that's the way that she is. And we can negotiate out what risks we're willing to take in order to afford that person greater independence. There's nothing wrong with that model. And it's been fought out over many, many years how much additional care I can provide to somebody before all of a sudden they should be considered to be a nursing home person. But it's a broad, broad range. Right now, we're actually seeing the antithesis of that problem. We're seeing people who are in assisted living facilities, licensed as residential care facilities, who on a daily basis are receiving at least as much or more care that you would receive than the lightest folks within a nursing home. The overlap is there. In the industry, we often refer to it as care creep. In other words, this person is private pay. I don't want to lose them from my facility. I didn't really have the intention of having to have, you know, somebody that it took two people to move them from bed to chair or chair to bed. But over time, I've creeped in giving them more care in order to keep them here with me, in order to keep them as my customer. And so I'm adding in more services and more services and more services. And sure enough, if you go to the Ohio Department of Health and you look where there are violations of assisted living facilities, you'll usually see them falling into one of these two areas. You'll either see them as disputes or problems where they weren't clear about what services they were providing for the dollars that they were providing. Or what we're increasingly finding is you're seeing facilities that attempted to take on something that was probably a little bit more than their staffing model and their experience gave them the capability of doing. And they were managing medications at a level that was far higher than what they were probably originally prepared to do. They were taking care of folks that needed supervision, that it was a higher level. But they wanted to try to keep this person. Now, that may have been for the best of motives. It may have been for financial motives. And those aren't the worst of motives. This is a business in that regard. You can't knock them for wanting to do that. God bless them. The family said, I want to stay here. They said, okay, it's going to take us more money to do that. We agree to do that and provide those services. The state has to then come in and say, yeah, but were you capable of doing that? We appreciate your motives on this for whatever they were, but you just didn't have the acumen, the staffing ratio to be able to do that. Okay? So given that breadth, assisted living, that's the big asterisk, right? The caveat I've got in assisted living. Given this, that broad is assisted living, what do people pay for assisted living in Ohio, according to this recent data? What's your guess? How much a year? $50,000 is on the table. $45,000. Okay, now we're like doing the prices right. The question is, do I look like Bob Barker or do I look like Drew Carey? Okay. All right, and Carol Merrill will come on up. No, sorry. The answer is $54,300. Yeah. And I guess my point is, recognizing again Mark Twain's comments about lies and statistics, we are recognizing the fact that that number may not mean a whole lot depending upon who those people are that are receiving the assisted living. Now let's shift to nursing home. Nursing home is a much more standardized version of what it is that you have to do for someone. So under circumstances, we would think economically that that should be a much more stable number. You comprehensively need to provide for all the care needs of the individual that comes in. And your payment that you receive each month means you have full responsibility, full, if you will, healthcare fiduciary responsibility for their safety, well-being, and monitoring and maintenance of their healthcare. That's the expectation when they come into the nursing home. It's much more comprehensive. Okay, it's not negotiated. It is what it is. All right? But, okay, you thought this one was going to be easy. But here's the little spin I want to put on it. 65 to 70% of the people who are receiving that care are not paying for it themselves. It isn't a private market. It does not have economic efficiencies, for those of you who have studied economics. It isn't that somebody's offering a service and someone's choosing to pay for the service, and we have what's referred to as a price elasticity of demand, where certain consumers will be willing to pay something else, and all those effects of competition and the like. There is a fixed payer, a third party, who is paying on behalf of well over half of the people who are receiving the services. In economics, they refer to that as an oligopoly. Okay? But what we know is it has a bizarre, twisted effect in terms of economics. It means that the price is either going to get pulled down by that one payer, that one buyer of services, or it's going to get pulled up. But it's going to massively move that average around because the fact of the matter is you've got one party, in this case the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services through the Medicaid program, that is the largest single purchaser. That the more than the majority of people who are living in a nursing home right now are in fact not customers. They're consumers. More importantly, incidentally, they're human beings made in the image and likeness of God, deserving of all the dignity and compassion that goes within. But from a pure economic standpoint, they're not customers. They're not exchanging any value. Somebody else is paying on their behalf. And that somebody else can either pay more or less as a very large purchaser of services. Any of you that are in the business world know exactly what I'm talking about in terms of the reason that you want vendor size, right? You want the ability to be able to move the market and get the best price that you possibly can. And what happens if the large vendor in your industry decides that they're going to pay at a different rate? Either forcing you to be the profit margin for the other guy, or you to slide along and ride that tide on up. So the truth of the matter is, when you tell me now in a second how much it costs, for a year at a nursing home, we're going to have to say, wait a second, that's very much skewed by what Medicaid is paying in our particular state, and it might be very different, and incidentally it is, if you cross the border toward Pennsylvania versus you cross the border toward Michigan versus you cross the border toward West Virginia. Very different dynamics in terms of how much is being paid. What's your best guess on the price in the greater Cleveland area for a year of semi-private? You're sharing this the same way Medicaid does. You're sharing this with another human being. That's if the place has all private beds, then that's what Medicaid pays for as well. But Medicaid will, if there is the capability of two people sharing a room together of the same gender, two people sharing a room together, that's what Medicaid says we'll pay for, and nothing more than that above and beyond. What do you think that price is per year? $85,000, $70,000, $72,000. We are coalescing around the number. If we keep doing this long enough, we're going to actually make our way around $79,753. Fresh data, $79,000 for a semi-private room. You want to live by yourself and have your own single room in that, it's going to cost you another $6,000 a year more than that. Which, depending upon your life experience, if you had the resources to do that, if you were actually the one paying the $79,000, you might at that point want to say, you know what, I'll pay the $85,775 for the private room. But given the fact that I just told you that well over half of the people aren't the ones making that decision, they will take the room that is available to them within that particular facility. Okay? Now, I have no idea why this is the case, but since I am right now speaking to you on the cusp of, on the edge of Summit County, I figured I might as well disclose to you that for reasons I haven't been able to figure out, but I'm going to have some fun with at some point in time, much to my wife's chagrin probably, because I'll be coming up with my theories late night sitting around talking to her. The Akron-Canton area is actually more expensive. Akron-Canton, semi-private room in Akron-Canton is almost $87,000. And a private room in Akron-Canton is $92,000 per year. Wasn't quite sure. Speculating. Might be the number of amount of Medicaid penetration. It might be the number of urban homes. I have no idea. I'm not even going to speculate, but it is what it is. Yeah, it's we'd have to do the math to do it. If it's 43 for 8 hours, is going to cost you $43,000 a year to get it. Take that number times four.
Oh, okay.
Right? Did I do four? Four times three. Sorry, times three. Times three. It's 1/3 of it is what we just paid. So multiply that by three. So $100,000, ballpark. Thank you. I said I can do statistics. I didn't say I can do arithmetic. Okay, there's a difference between those two. So, okay, continuous care retirement communities. I included these up here because I had described them to you when we first started. Okay, and here's the it depends. The concept of having multiple services of multiple levels under one roof or on one campus, a continuous care retirement community, does not necessarily imply that there's another contract involved that involves front-end endowment giving of money. It's common, as I told you before. There are a number of continuous care retirement communities where for some, in many cases, a very significant sum, let's say averaging, I don't know, a ballpark, around a quarter to a third of $1 million, you give them these dollars that may actually return back to your estate after your death in some cases, or a portion back toward your estate, or may decrease over long periods of time. But you give some front-end money into the community, and then you pay a fee month by month, either a flat fee, which we generally refer to as life care, or a fee that increases on the basis of the services that you're receiving, and you get to live at this place. And you get to use the available services there within this. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that kind of an arrangement. There are a number of places now who simply are building that continuum of care, and you can come in at any point in the continuum of care that you want to, and there's no front-end fee necessarily to be a part of that. If you want an independent apartment, you pay for an independent apartment. But you'll be in the place where you know that should I need to, I will go over there. The key is, are they obliged to do that? Are there any laws, are there any contractual reasons, private arrangements that you've made with these folks other than the general sense of if they have an available bed, I get to go to the available bed? And that's an important consideration. In the true construct of a continuous care retirement community, there is actually a contractual guarantee, if you will, that within those parameters laid out, you know exactly where you're going to be. Now, increasingly, that element has been linking to this element back here. I have an increasing number of clients. I'm not saying the data is too thin at this point for me to give you an opinion, but I'm encouraged by it. I have a number of folks that are joining at-home programs. They are living in their own private residence. They're joining at-home programs of continuous care retirement communities. They pay a small fee, sometimes a one-time fee, sometimes a monthly fee. And honestly, what they end up doing in most cases is they go over to the care facility. Now, don't get me wrong. This is wise marketing on the part of the care facility, right? I mean, they're trying to level in the moat that exists conceptually around their place. Okay, they're trying to get people to come in and see, hey, guess what? We're nice here. You know, and our food's better than you thought it was going to be. And so whatever else, other objections there are. But these are folks who are living in their own house in the community. For a relatively reasonable amount of money, they have given themselves access to go over to the care facility to use the gym, to use the pool, to get a massage, to, you know, see a therapist if they want to and pay for it, to go and have lunch together. And as importantly from the perspective of the facility, but I think it's important as well, is and to join the rest of the residents when they go to the art museum or when they go to the orchestra or when they do whatever it is that they do, when the kids are all coming in for all the Christmas programs. It gives them a chance to become part integrated into this. Yes, it's marketing. It gives them the opportunity to say, you know what, when I get more frail on this, or when I get sick to death of having to, you know, hire landscapers and take care of my house, this is where I'm going to go. Yes, that's good business. But it also makes perfect sense from a gerontological perspective that this would be a good thing for the person to do. So we're starting to see links here between the continuum of care is now moving beyond the buildings and the campus. The continuum of care of continuous care retirement communities is moving out to the community. That's pretty exciting. That's pretty neat. Some of the better around the country, some of the better dementia, Alzheimer's-based daycare programs are actually, some of them started as university-based programs. They started as research programs, frankly, people like me. But many of them have been integrated into continuous care retirement communities for this very reason. That they're looking at it and they're saying, if Mr. X brings Mrs. X over, Mrs. X has a nice day, Mr. X could immediately run straight back out to the parking lot and get in his car and go to his club or go shopping or do whatever else he needs to do. But he might stick around and have lunch with us. He might stick around and be a part of our caregiver support group. He might be a part of some of the other services that we're providing. And we've now brought this family under our continuum of care in a positive way for us, hopefully a positive way for them. But start looking around for those at-home programs if this is relevant for you, because this is an area that I see a lot of growth and a lot of potential expansion. And they're usually pretty to be in the program is relatively inexpensive. The care facility, the continuum of care, the CCRC is different. Okay, payment options. Somebody answer for me. Why did I strike a line through Medicare, Medicaid, Medicare, Medicare supplement as a means? I apologize. Medicare I put down as my first potential payment source, but then I struck a line through it. Why would I do that? Does Medicare pay for long-term care? Who disagrees with that? Well, remember, sir, Bill, do you think so? They do pay for it. Well, remember when we did the statistics part? And I said, well, here's the off-quoted statistic. 78% of people receive some form of long-term care services. That number included all of those folks who came out of the hospital, got some rehab at a long-term care facility. So if you're going to use that number, you got to use Medicare as one of your payment sources. If you're going to toss out that number and say, no, come on, you're talking about medical rehab. You're talking about really post-acute. You're talking about someone who's restoring. They're getting better. This isn't long-term care. If you're going to pitch that person out, then go ahead and pitch out Medicare along with it. But the bottom line is, when you become a beneficiary of Medicare, which you do if 65, blind, disabled, it is the foremost health insurance program in the United States of America. I think we're all aware of that. More participants than any other health insurance program, and it includes people who are 65, blind, disabled, some survivors, some other kinds of things, elements involved in it. Medicare is medical insurance. Here's where that issue when I said before about the word health insurance starts to get confused about things. What does health really mean? In this case, we say it's health insurance. What we mean is it pays for doctors, it pays for hospitals, it pays for rehab, it pays for skilled specialists, it pays, in most cases, some cases, for nurses and so on and so forth. And it pays for the ancillary services, you know, the meals, the space, the bed, that go along with those services. But you have to be getting better. The idea was this is a part of your medical insurance. We don't pay for you for what we would refer to as palliative or custodial care. We don't pay just because you can't do stuff for yourself, because you have a functional disability. That's not Medicare. Medicare's involvement is, and hence you'll reach these issues. Incidentally, most people don't realize, when I was working with the Ombudsman Program, I think I'm pretty convinced people thought that our most common complaint was actually bad food. But it wasn't. Actually, the most often, many years in the statistics, the most common complaint actually had to do with the Medicare advocacy work that we did. People being booted out of Medicare earlier than they believed they should. So they went to the hospital. Then they went from the hospital to some kind of rehab or skilled nursing facility. They were receiving care. And they were informed by the physical therapy staff or the occupational therapy staff or the administrators that they had plateaued. That's it. we're not filing any more bills to Medicare. We don't think we're going to get paid for them because you don't get any more services. That was a common place of conflict because the family was saying, no, I see her getting better. Or I see that if you just gave her a little bit more of the antidepressant medicine and gave her a little more time for it to work, she would do better. She's refusing it. But I know her. You don't know her. If only she was getting this other area of care, she'd be able to respond to the physical therapy. You're cutting her off from the physical therapy too early on this. That knee, that hip is never going to get any better if we don't do this right now. It might get worse. Can you please go treat this other illness first? In this most cases, in many cases, mental illness first. And then we'll go back and try the PT again. But you're saying she's exhausted, she's out of this because that's the way that your system works. That was a very common area of advocacy that we got involved with folks. Much more common than most people realize. And it related to, fundamentally, the fact that Medicare does not pay for long-term care. It pays for rehabilitative acute care, extended acute care. Okay? And obviously, those of you who are on Medicare know that Medicare doesn't pay for everything. In fact, I think there's late-night television commercials that remind you of that on a regular basis. Thankfully, none of you are watching those because there was no kind of moments of 3 a.m. cheap commercials for Medicare supplement insurance policies that popped into your faces. But a Medicare supplement is, you know, there's a deductible to Medicare on the hospital side, and there's a copay obligation on the Part B portion that has to do with paying physicians and other therapists and the like. And that part, often, most folks will have a private supplement they often call the Medigap policy to cover that. Those go where Medicare goes. So they don't provide any additional services. Some Medigap policies, what we call Advantage plans, have some other services built into them in exchange for some things that you give up, maybe in terms of choice of providers and things like that. And there'll be some cool stuff like Silver Sneaker programs and things like that. But for the most part, where goes Medicare, so goes your Medigap policy. And that's not for long-term care. So personal income is the primary means that many folks will use, or at least use initially. Obviously, with the numbers that we were just talking about before, there aren't a whole lot of people walking around on the planet that have monthly income to be able to meet the kinds of charges that we're talking about folks are averaging who are receiving these services. Okay? You'd have to have a lot of assets, a big honking pension, something to be able to cover those kinds. But initially, folks will address that out of their personal income. But ultimately, many folks will end up reaching into their personal savings and invested assets. And as we'll talk about, hopefully, in the next 30 minutes, there are some strategies that can be used for how to best manage your assets to be able to stretch those out and take care of them. To be able to use them for those reasons. I wanted to touch upon some of these others because you'll hear about them. How many of you have heard of or done any investigation of what a reverse mortgage is? Yes? Yeah? Heard? Right? Right? I mean, I'm not making a commentary upon ex-Senator Fred Thompson, but I personally liked Law and Order. Dum dum. Right? I thought it's a good show, all right? I don't know how he was as a senator, but you will occasionally now, if you hang out like I do watching, you know, CNBC in the late hours, when I'm trying to find out what all your portfolios are doing, you will occasionally see him talking about reverse mortgages. And Robert Wagner, who I only remember was with Natalie Wood or something, I don't know, there's lots of different reasons. These folks come on and did talk about reverse mortgages, okay? Bottom line is we're talking about reaching into the value inside of your home, either by doing that by taking a loan like you would a home equity loan from a bank. Pretty tough to do, incidentally, if you don't have adequate income to be able to cover your expenses already. Banks tend not to want to give you that money. If you had it anyway, it was already built in, you've been sitting on this home equity line for a while, I suppose you could reach into it. But by and large, you're probably not going to get a new one when you also tell them that right now your expenses are far exceeding your income. But in any case, a reverse mortgage is a situation, and it's cleaned up a lot over the years. And don't get me wrong, the fees have dropped down. There's been a number of regulatory efforts to try to make this market a little bit more useful. But the fundamental idea is that a homeowner who has equity in their house can arrange a loan with a private bank, but structured through the FHA, through Housing and Urban Development, so it's a very structured loan, to be able to reach into their house and get money out of the equity of their house, obviously devaluing the house either suddenly with one lump payment or over time through kind of an annuity base where they get sent a check every month, or on the IFCUM, like a checkbook, you know, that they could reach into it like a line of credit and grab this money as they needed to pay their expenses. Devaluing, obviously, the value of the house. It's got an interesting set of rules attached to it, just real briefly without going in. We can go in more into detail in a couple, in a little bit if you want me to. But the interesting sets of rules that, you know, unlike most bank loans, the rules by which this allows you, can I get a higher loan to value, right? How much money can I get out of my house? If I've got $100,000 of equity in my house, how much of that $100,000 can I get? Well, normally, for the rest of us in this room, the usual way that we'd ask that question if you were going to a bank officer is they'd look at your income, they'd look at your FICO score, they'd see what loan to value they were willing to give you, how much of your equity you're allowed to reach into that they're comfortable, right, based on the value of your house and so on and so forth. In the case of these HUD programs, it's based on how old you are. Because the underlying assumption is, if you're closer to being dead, you can go ahead and take more money out of this, and we're less likely to be on the hook for whatever's left over. It is a federally guaranteed program. So there's actually some kind of cool things about this. You just need to make sure that all parties are very aware of what's going on. In other words, like, inform the kids that the house might not have a whole lot of value by the time they get to it. Inform the federal legislators who think this is wonderful and they're going to get votes from all the old people that if that house devalues and you let the old lady get $95,000 out of her $100,000 on it and now the house is only worth $70,000, the taxpayers are not going to be really happy with you because you just gave her a bunch of money that you can't get back. So the program has certain catches to it that we just need to be very mindful of. But for the right person, it is a means of reaching into something they own that otherwise is illiquid. They can't get their hands on it, and giving them the opportunity to be able to pay for it. But there's a good bit of devil in the details. There's a good bit of fees compared to a normal loan. Where it ran into many, many problems is that it was seen as a source of income that many older adults could use to then invest. And we had a real problem, particularly with those who were selling other illiquid instruments. In other words, financial advisors, and I use that term very, very loosely, financial advisors who were advising people, in fact, they were selling people, on the idea that they could get a reverse mortgage, pull the money out as a lump sum, taking it out of that illiquid position, making it liquid, only to purchase an annuity and make it illiquid again. And that there was some wisdom in doing that. Those kinds of arrangements really put a bad name on this whole approach. But it is important to consider that for the right person, where that home equity really isn't worth much more to them, the kids don't want that house, they'll have to sell it when it's all over, but they need the income, they need the cash, that might be a perfectly legitimate way of doing it. A number of you had some questions about long-term care insurance that you brought to me. So that's good. We'll take a little bit of time in a couple minutes talking with some greater detail about it. Suffice to say that there's been enormous, enormous changes in that market within the last even 3 years, 3-4 years. It's by way of insurance, it's a relatively new product, if you will, in terms of a couple of decades old. But it's maybe a bit more. But the idea is not all that complicated. For most people, you purchased it as you would a term life insurance policy or your health insurance. You paid a fee on a monthly basis. Maybe you paid it annualized because it gave you a little bit of savings. But you paid for a period of time to have a smaller amount of money to have the rights to a bigger amount of money. Okay? Insurance. Classic kind of health insurance model. If at the end of the month you realized, oh my gosh, I'm still independent in all my activities of daily living. I didn't qualify for my insurance. Hopefully your response is not, darn, I wasted that money. Hopefully your response is, thank God, I didn't need it. Much like we do with our health insurance. Because what we know is, if actually I'm asking myself that conversation, and I'm in the emergency room, and they're talking about what pin they're going to put into what joint of me, at that point, I'm real thankful that I paid that little amount of premium in exchange for the vast amount of money it's going to take from what I'm going to need from this point forward. It's insurance. That's the way that it worked, okay? Difficulty was it sounded so good, particularly to the insurance companies. They're looking at the statistics I'm looking at. They probably read their own statistics and stupidly believed them in terms of wow, we've got this huge emerging market and all these folks are going to want to do this, so let's just get product out. And they started competing with each other. And no, I can do it cheaper than you can, and I can give you this bell and whistle, and I can give you this bell and whistle. And they started competing with each other. And I'm not sure, I don't know how many, are any actuaries in this room? Most of it, does anybody know an actuary? Yeah, I know a couple. They're usually kind of quiet people. You know, they're usually not particularly bold out there. And so if you had a room that had a bunch of salespeople and a group of actuaries, who's going to get heard? Right? I mean, come on. So something happened along the way that somebody finally up in the executive suites looked around and said, how about we ask the actuaries? And they said, we have no idea how to predict that risk. You are talking about a moving target of moving targets. How many old people are going to use what kind of services that you can't even tell me what those services are going to be and for how long they're going to need them? They started looking at the real statistics that we were just talking about, and a lot of companies have pulled back out of that market, particularly companies that at one time were offering them to large amounts of people at deeply discounted prices, like those that were offering them to government employees, pensioners, so on and so forth. They got a lot of covered lives they've already got it taken care of. And actuarially, insurance companies need to have the money in the coffers someplace to be able to cover the lives that they've promised on those guarantees. So many of them are saying, I'm staying put on this. Those that aren't are increasingly going, and some that have already come out of the market, are increasingly going to state insurance commissioners one by one, one state at a time, four blocks of business, usually in 5 to 10 year periods of blocks, and they're requesting permission from the state insurance commissioner to raise the premiums on everybody in that. And what we're seeing, where I get concerned, is we're seeing folks who are saying, it was barely affordable to me before, it's not affordable to me any longer, I guess I have to walk away from it. And they may have paid in decades into this policy and never see a dime out of it because of that premium increase. And so from an advocacy perspective, we're really looking right now at saying, wait a second, I appreciate the insurance company's problems. I appreciate the fact that they do have recourse by coming to the departments of insurance. I also appreciate the fact that in many states, our own included, want to be careful, occasionally, anyway, Department of Insurance is the kind of place where you don't actually have a financial professional running it. You had that last highest-ranking legislator of the majority party that lost their seat and are sitting waiting around to restart their next campaign. And they give them insurance as the department to run for a period of time so that they can keep their name on something. They may not actually be professionals in that field. And we're now dealing with some really substantial risks of people not having those dollars even after putting them in. That's not a way to right-side that market. But long-term care insurance is still the fundamental concept, still makes sense, right? You got a 50-50 chance, remember, guys? Not you as a whole group. There your chance is quite small. But you don't know where you fit into this. It is a classic insurance problem, right? Large amount of money required, low probability of it occurring. But if it occurred, you'd need a boatload more money than you have. That sounds to me like what you insure for. That sounds to me like how it's worked out for your house all these years. How many fires have you had on your house? For real. Most of it is none, thank God. How many years have you been paying insurance to make sure that you were covered for a fire on your house? You never thought twice about doing that. Why? Because the cost of replacing the whole house is more than I've got. Of course I'm going to do that. This is your house we're talking about. This is your care we're talking about. This is how you will live your life for a period of time. Or people you love will live their lives. But we don't hesitate for a second to see the insurance issue. And I don't want to take away from the challenges of the dollars involved in it and how organic this problem is and, frankly, how infantile we are in our understanding of it. But it does make sense that insurance would be at least a way of considering paying for this. And all of this, and it needs to be continued to work. One of the innovations that's been going on increasingly has to do with there is a community of people, many of whom may be in this room, who, you know what, I probably have enough assets to be able to set aside to be able to self-insure, particularly in light of the risks that you're talking about, Richard. You know, if I'm one of the folks that it's just going to be a small period of my life at most that I'm ever going to need care. And I'm looking around and I'm saying I'm not alone. I have a spouse. I have kids. I have a social structure. I think I'm not in one of those super uber high risk people to have to incur these costs. Then I think I probably self-funding makes sense. And I certainly know that what I'm doing with my money right now is earning me more in potential value, how I'm managing my resources right now, than it would be if I tossed it into one of those insurance policies. But I'm not 100% sure. So what could I do? Short answer is, increasingly, life insurance companies, sometimes in cooperation with their long-term care insurance arm, are creating these hybrid products where it's not a use-it-or-lose-it kind of thing. It's not like your health insurance. It's not like a term policy where I pay that premium that month or that year and then bye-bye. If I didn't need it, thank God you didn't need it. In this case, there will be some value that will come back. I'll either use it in my life because I need care, or someone will get it as a death benefit after my death. And it allows me to take money that I might have been planning on passing on to my next generation or to a charitable organization and reallocating those dollars elsewhere. So it allows me to purchase. Sometimes they're single premium. Sometimes they're paid up over 7 years or 10 years. It all depends. Okay? They're more expensive. But there's at least that value. At least I know every dollar I put into this thing, at least that amount of money, and in many cases, much, much more than that. Now, if I do this when I'm in my 50s and 60s, which incidentally is when people are buying long-term care insurance, if I do this in my 50s and 60s, I might pay X dollars into this thing. I might have 2X of value for life insurance. It's not a great life insurance policy, but it's okay. Keeps up with the cost of maybe what my conservative portfolio would have yielded for that same money. Somebody's going to get something good out of it, but it might be 5 or 6X in terms of its value for long-term care. So if in the unlikely event, statistically, that I actually needed it, I got a good chunk of money to be able to use to be able to for the long-term care. So this is the way a lot of us are now looking at our long-term care. And in answer to whoever asked me that question, what are I and my wife doing, this is the area that we're looking at. Because as I saw my best options in the pay-as-you-go model, we're getting reduced and reduced and reduced. Nobody was offering 10 pays any longer, multi-pays. They weren't giving a chance where they were going to guarantee me a certain amount of benefit after a certain time. I might still be making payments in my 80s and rate increases in my 80s. They didn't like that option. So now what we're looking at is getting the rest of the estate plan settled enough that we might be able to shift over some dollars that otherwise we would have wanted to pass on to the kids someday or to ministry someday, and to do it this way. That upon the second death, if we'd never needed those monies for anything else, they're going to go on as value to somebody in the form of death benefit. But if we needed them in our lifetime, we'd be able to use them for long-term care at a higher value. So be watching for this as well, okay, as one of the innovations that's going on. And it's a pretty exciting one if you have the resources or can start to set aside the resources to be able to do that. This is likely not a solution that you can... that would be for more moderate or lower income folks. This is a middle income and up kind of strategy in most cases. In most cases, it's always worth looking at. Can't hurt. Okay. VA and Medicaid. Those are public benefits. They're public benefits, but they're different from each other, and I believe morally, biblical morality, a very important distinction. And I don't want to belabor it, but I want to point it out. Somebody earned that VA benefit. In order to become a part of the homebound pension or the aid in attendance pension, those are the two levels of the VA non-service disability pension that is provided to a veteran or their surviving spouse. In order to do that, you had to serve at least one day in regular service of any of the branches during a combat period. You didn't have to be in combat. You could have been, you know, back up here at the Naval Accounting Office, if there was a Naval Accounting Office at that time. I don't know. But in any case, but you had to serve. And as of right now, I believe, I'm not sure whether Iraq and Afghanistan have been incorporated in. I know Desert Storm has certainly been incorporated in. But you had to be during a period of conflict. So in other words, you at least made your life available, either as a volunteer or a draftee. You made your life available to be in harm's way on my behalf. You did something for all of us. we owe something to you. I know that this particular day, and it's one I hope is in all of our prayers, this particular day happens to be one where if you've watched the news every day this week, you know that the behavior of the Veterans Administration and our ability to keep the promises to the men and women that have served us is becoming a focal point for our country. And it should be. Whatever else your feelings are about the politics of one particular conflict or another, I think it's very clear that if you take your biblical ethics, you would say we owe an honor, a special honor, to those who were willing to stand and protect us in one form or another. Even if fundamentally we thought they were standing too long for their own good and for ours, they were willing to serve in that capacity. We owe them something. The way the program works, and to be clear, it does have income and asset resource eligibility limitations. You can't be a high net worth veteran and expect to receive the aid and attendance program even if you're quite disabled. They will expect you to diminish yourself of your resources first. Interestingly, it doesn't have near the level of rules that we have on the Medicaid program. For example, some people aren't aware of this, there is a piece of legislation bouncing its way around in the House of Representatives. I'm no political scientist, but I can tell you right now, it ain't going anywhere in light of everything else that's going on over at the VA. But it is to establish the first known penalty for transferring assets. There are folks, it is lawful at the present time, to give my money to my kids and then go over to the VA and file as a veteran if I have a disability and receive my pension and just have my kids hold the money, okay? Or put it into an irrevocable trust, but just leave it out of my ownership. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not in any way, shape, or form, and I'm being recorded right now, I'm not in any way, shape, or form recommending that. And my reasons are plentiful. The first and foremost is I think there is a moral issue in that, and you need to think it through. The second is, in terms of at least think that through. The second is, and maybe more importantly, is if those assets were not so great that at some point you did need Medicaid at some time in the future, unless 5 years has gone by, Medicaid will penalize you for having given away those dollars. The VA might not care, but the county sure will, and the state sure will, that you disposed of your assets and now are asking them for their help. You can't ask for their help within 60 months of the time that you did that. Furthermore, I know you love your kids. I know you respect your kids. I know you're sure that nothing bad would ever happen with the dollars that you gave to them. But I do this for a living, and you're wrong. Sadly, as often in the body of Christ as it happens out there in the rest of the big bad world, marriages dissolve. In the state of Ohio, that means if I gave my son or my daughter that money, half of it belongs to their spouse upon ending that marriage, lawfully. If, sadly, in this economy, people aren't able always to meet their bills, there's disabilities that they didn't have health care for, there's challenges, there's businesses that go bust, they're not able to meet their bills, and they need to file for bankruptcy. If I gave my assets to my kid, that's my kid's asset, and would be available to help them resolve any of their bankruptcy issues. It would have to be tapped into. I have had too many, far too many, tearful members of one generation or another pleading with me saying, that's not my money. It's my mom's money. It's not my money. That's my daughter's money. I'm just holding it for her. And it doesn't make a difference. So, making sure, and the reason I'm mentioning it in light of this, even though one program says it's perfectly acceptable to do so, you need to move the chess pieces out a couple more times to stop and say, well, what's the likelihood, given the rest of the resources, the income, the need, the changing need, that I might then fall afoul of other obligations that I had to keep and really, really mess up this situation? We do have a couple of questions, and I'm going to get to them actually just in a couple of minutes, about wills and trusts and holding assets by each other. This is probably a perfectly appropriate point for me to say when we're talking about any kind of transfers of assets. When you give someone else the ability to control your funds, you have to do so very, very carefully. We have powers of attorney that basically say, as a legal document, I'll walk through it real quickly, powers of attorney that say that I'm giving you the lawful responsibility. You can act as my fiduciary. You can act as me. But it doesn't indicate to anybody that you own my stuff. It means you're allowed to control my stuff. That's a very, big, very big difference than that sweet little bank teller who tells you, oh, just put it in a joint account so that you're able to help your mom with it. In most cases, that little sweet bank teller that told you to put that simple little joint account just meant that that money's yours now. Yours. Open to your creditors. Available for your use. It's not what you asked for, but it was a simple way for them to be able to address servicing your particular needs on a timely basis without bringing in all those lawyers and all that sort of stuff. It also ends up failing miserably when one or another party thinks that they actually own those dollars and they find out that actually they're just equally owned or shared with another party. Okay. I won't belabor this, but I've alluded to the business of elder care. You know, I've talked about nursing homes that have, or assisted living facilities that may have a financial conflict of interest, if you will, in terms of determining what level of care you get. I've talked about you know, the fact that these behave, that we've decided, for whatever reason, good or ill, we've decided to have these services try to work within the same type of market economy we use to buy refrigerators and television sets. Okay? There's some, now you need to understand, before I sound wickedly socialist to you, you know, I do actually have an MBA. I mean, I actually believe in this stuff, that the markets are a wonderfully effective means of distributing goods and services. Most of the time they work. They don't always work when it comes to healthcare. I mean, we don't have to get ideological to come to that conclusion. We can simply see that if I was going to buy a television set or a refrigerator, I might go to Consumer Reports, I might check around online, I might, you know, have my cute little app on my phone that lets me blip the price of this one over at the other place and by looking at the little SKUs and, you know, all the kinds of things I would do to make sure that I was getting maximum value on this. If you told me that my wife had some severe cancer and that the only place that she could be treated was in Rochester, Minnesota, or down in Texas, I'm trying to figure out, am I buying the airfare commercial or am I trying to see if I can get somebody to fly me privately? I don't have price elasticity of demand. I'm not acting as an economic agent in some reasonable, economically efficient fashion. The person I love most in this world needs something. Mortgage everything I got. I don't care. Make it go away. Fix it. There are elements in our life where markets, frankly, just don't work for that particular good or service. And we're not exactly sure to what degree caring for another human being in a way that is compassionate and dignified and involves that definition of caring, whether that, frankly, works very well in a market economy. But that's where we are right now. And so it's very important that we keep a balance on that. That we who, as biblical people, are called to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, that we are wise in understanding the other party's interests, that we don't let the pendulum swing to one side or another of you greedy, and hence listen to nothing about where they're coming from and what their interest is and what they need to be able to be viable to sustain the service that they want to provide in the community, or swing it out to the other end of the perspective. You know, and pitch it out and say, well, it's what it costs. Too bad for those poor people. Glad I'm not one of them. That we need, as wise people, taking the fullness of the scriptures, to stop and say, how do I approach the fact that we have decided as a community that we're going to provide these services within the context of a market economy, modified deeply by things like the Medicaid program that's involved in it. Okay. Likewise, and I'm looking in the mirror now, there is a business to the providing of assistance with elder care. Whether it is a financial planner like me, whether it's an attorney, whether it is a social worker, whether it is the admissions person of a care facility, whether it is a referral agency that says, incidentally, for free, I'll help you find the best home. Wait a second. Correct me. Anybody ever know how to do something for free and keep doing it every day and still be able to eat? How do we figure that one out? Didn't that already start to make you feel a little uncomfortable? Wait a second. How do you give me this for free? And the short answer is someone else is paying me. I get a commission. What? You get a commission from every place that you're going to take me to? No. Actually, I get a commission only from the ones that are willing to pay me a commission. Well, doesn't that make it more likely that you're only going to show me to the places that we're going to pay you? Possibly. That would be a really, really wise question to ask, wouldn't it? But we won't get there if either we like the warms and fuzzies of saying, oh, it's free. You care about me. Richard Martin, wasn't he a great guy? Yeah, wow. I gave you a freebie on a Saturday. Let's be straight about this. I can't give a freebie for every dollar of my life. I'm not a trust fund baby. There's going to have to be some exchange of compensation at some point to get counsel from people. You know, as one older pastor once shared with me, and if you don't charge nothing, you ain't no good. We want to be realistic about this, whether it's in the form of that admissions director at the area nursing home that is just so sweet. Guess what? She is sweet. He is sweet. They're good people, but they do have to make a living. And so we need to stop with wisdom, not letting the pendulum swing out to either side ideologically, and simply say, what's your interest? What do you want? And if your interest overlaps with my interest, good, let's do it. Let's work together. But if your interest at any point potentially conflicts with mine, I at least need to know that. I need to be thinking about that. And frankly, I would have liked you to disclose that to me in good faith if at some point you believe that your interest and my interest might not completely overlap. Because if I discovered on my own, I'm probably not going to trust you very much. And so it would be wiser if you go ahead and disclose that right up front.